Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode, I believe, 159 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts, and I will continue the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be an internal medicine focused podcast. I would love to make more podcasts than I do on a daily basis. It's just literally time is my big limiting factor. Okay, let's just jump right into it, right? So what if you get a question? And the thing is, I try to write a few, or at least mentally come up with a few vignettes, USMLE style vignettes. So I'll read them out, read the answer, talk through, throughout some answer choices there, and then we'll talk about the answer choices. So what if you get a question about a 65-year-old male, comes to the PCP, has a 2-week history of hematuria, and then, other than an unintentional 20-pound weight loss over the last 3 months, he has no other complaints. He worked in a shipyard for 20 years as a plumber before retiring 5 years ago. His physical exam is unremarkable. He has no evidence of suprapubic pain or pressure. His prostate is smooth and non-tender on digital rectal exam. His medical history is notable for granulomatosis with polyangiitis, which has been well controlled with appropriate medications, right? And then he smoked 2 cigarettes every day over a 1-month period while studying abroad in China 49 years ago, right? He occasionally has a glass of wine with dinner. Urinalysis is positive for gross hematuria, but negative for nitrites, leukocyte esterase, and dysmorphic red blood cells. What is the most significant risk factor for this patient's presenting symptoms? So the first answer choice, we have occupational history. Second one is history of smoking. Third one, let's call it history of alcohol abuse. Fourth one, let's call it medication exposure. And then fifth one, let's call it prostate malignancy. So first option, occupational history. Option B, history of smoking. Option C, history of alcohol abuse. Option D, medication exposure. Option E, prostate malignancy. So the right answer here is actually medication exposure. So I can already imagine some people listening to this podcast are already throwing their arms up oh, Divine, wait, what's going on here, right? So first things first, right? This person likely, I told you, for every MBME question, what is the first thing you should always do? You should always make a diagnosis, right? So the diagnosis here, right, is bladder cancer. This person's got bladder cancer. And I'm sure you've probably listened to some past podcast I made where I said, oh, what is the biggest risk factor for bladder cancer? I said, ooh, smoking. But now I'm seeing medication exposure, right? So, but think about it, right? This guy has smoked 2 cigarettes every day for a month. And this was 49 years ago in China. Does that sound like smoking will be the most? Again, that's why, again, you can't just memorize facts on USMLE exams, right? You also, again, have to understand the context of the question. That's kind of important, right? So this person, right, has a history of Wegener's, right? So granulomatosis with polyangiitis. And remember that is usually actually treated with steroids and cyclophosphamide, right? So remember that cyclophosphamide actually is a risk factor. It's actually a fairly significant risk factor for the future development of bladder cancer, right? And remember, cyclophosphamide in and of itself can injure the bladder, although you can kind of prevent, it can cause hemorrhagic cystitis. You can prevent that by, giving Mesna, because it will bind up the acrolein, a nasty byproduct. And you also want to do, very vigorous hydration. And again, like I said, smoking is the biggest risk factor for the development of bladder cancer, but the person's smoking history is too limited, it's too remote, his smoking cannot be the reason he's developed the bladder cancer, right? And then remember, right, that your next step, essentially in evaluation of this patient, right, you want to make sure you get a cystoscopy or biopsy. And also don't forget that schistosoma hematobium, right? So if you talk about a person from Egypt or whatever, right? Schistosoma hematobium, that's also a risk factor for bladder cancer. And again, classic presentation of bladder cancer, right? Hematuria, we're literally seeing not dysmorphic red blood cells or any of that crap. You're seeing literal red blood cells in a person's urine. So really bad hematuria, new onset varicocele in a long-term smoker. And then maybe they give you, new onset varicocele, long-term smoker. In fact, let me take a step back. If you see, if you see, let me put it this way so I don't confuse myself. So let me track back a little. So if you see hematuria, long history of smoking, right? And they don't mention anything like a flank mass or anything like that, you're likely dealing with bladder cancer. But if you see like hematuria, or you see like a new onset varicocele in like a long-term smoker, and let's say this smoker has like a flank mass, you're probably thinking about like renal cell carcinoma, right? And remember, one of the most common types is the clear cell type, right? And one high yield thing you want to know about renal cell carcinoma is you don't biopsy renal cell carcinoma. You just do a nephrectomy and that's it. Kind of like testicular cancer, right? Those GU malignancies in general, especially for like renal cell carcinoma, testicular cancers, usually not a good idea to biopsy those things so that you don't see the cancer. And remember, RCC has a strong association with a polycythemia, right? Because EPO can be produced, like erythropoietin can be produced in a paraneoplastic fashion. Now, what if you get a question about like a 23-year-old female, you know, she comes to the ED, she has like some roommates that are concerned because they've noticed that, man, over the last 2 weeks, her behavior has changed completely, right? And then they tell you that, oh, over the last week, she has been working on multiple projects that she says, oh, these projects will cure world poverty, right? And then they tell you that she sleeps less than 2 hours every day, but she has like insatiable energy to like, she can like, she's like Energizer Bunny, can go through the whole day, even with 2 hours of sleep. And then they tell you that, oh, let's say like you have like, you know, you assign a med student to interview this patient, and the med student is finding it difficult to get in any word during the interview, right? And then they say, you know, before these behavioral changes started, this person was actually like, you know, she was a straight A student, she was a barista at Starbucks, and she recently like started dating like a new boyfriend. And then they tell you that, you know, you get a urine toxicology screen, it's negative, you check blood alcohol levels, they are within normal limits. Now, this question then says, so let's assume the MBM question then says, in addition to beginning divalproex therapy, right, so like valproic acid, what is the next best step in the management of this patient, right? And then let's say option A says urine pregnancy test, option B says reassurance, option C says sertraline therapy, and option D says, I don't know, like throwing clozapine. How, why not? So clozapine therapy, right? So hopefully you may say, Divine, this is a side question. What's going on here? I think you, right? Again, first thing, you need to realize that the MBME, they love to integrate things. So they can give you a question that is seemingly a side question, but it's really for the most part a medicine question. That's kind of like my thought process with this one, right? So this person, if you're making a diagnosis, this person's got bipolar disorder, right? This person's got bipolar disorder, right? So the right answer here should actually be to get a urine pregnancy test, right? Because remember, valproic acid is super teratogenic, right? So you definitely want to make sure that, you know, you get a UPT, and you also want to make sure that you check their liver labs, because valproic acid is hepatotoxic. And it's actually kind of high yield to know some key drug associations with like some patient populations, right? So like, for example, isotretinoin, right? You should only start it after, again, you've obtained the pregnancy test, and you've confirmed that the person has like two types of birth control on board. Lithium, remember, lithium can cause Epstein's anomaly, right? Remember, where you have like atrialization of the right ventricle. In fact, for the most part, if a person has bipolar disorder in pregnancy, you can actually, if I'm not mistaken, the first line these days is haloperidol, believe it or not. And then, again, remember, if a woman is over 35 and she smokes, or she has like, you know, significant history of like thromboembolic disease, so let's say like she has like a prior history of DVT, you cannot give that woman a combined OCPs. And remember, if you get like a garden variety, okay, I shouldn't use that term, but if you just have a female that is reproductive age and has hypertension, the most likely cause of hypertension in that female, again, especially if she doesn't have significant risk factors, is likely going to be her use of combined OCPs, right? And again, remember, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, you don't want to use those in pregnancy. And remember that ACE inhibitors, right, if a person has a history of like bilateral renal artery stenosis or has hereditary angioedema, right, where you have like a C1-esterase inhibitor deficiency, you can't give ACE inhibitors. So you may say, Divine, why is that? Well, think about it, right? If a person has bilateral renal artery stenosis, the GFR is already in the toilet. It's terrible. So you don't want to add on something that will tank GFR even more, because remember, angiotensin 2 is a constrictor of the efferent arteriole, right? So that maintains GFR. So if you give an ACE inhibitor or you give an ARB, right, that would essentially like blunt the effects of angiotensin II. You would dilate the efferent arterial, and if that happens, your GFR will drop. If your GFR drops, that can throw the person into Florida renal failure. So you don't want to do that. And then if a person has a C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency, C1 esterase inhibitor, to make things easy, just think of it as something that breaks down bradykinin. I mean, yes, it breaks down bradykinin to inactive metabolites. So the thing is, ACE, also angiotensin converting enzyme, breaks down bradykinin to inactive metabolites as well. Let's just simplify it that way. That's a gross oversimplification, but it will do. Now, if, for example, a person already has a deficiency of C1 esterase inhibitor, well, you've knocked out one of two high yield pathways for breaking down bradykinin. So now they are left with that ACE pathway. That ACE pathway is all they have, really matters to them. So if you then decide to take that away by giving an ACE inhibitor, then you've knocked out two high yield pathways for breaking down bradykinin. So you no longer have the ability to break down bradykinin, right? And then you get into trouble, right? Because you can then begin to start having like, because remember, bradykinin can cause bronchoconstriction. It can increase vascular permeability. So those people have like their face swelling up, respiratory compromise and all that stuff, right? So those are people that you should not be giving ACE inhibitors or ARBs to. Now, what if you get a question about like a 50-year-old female, you know, she comes in, has like a large left breast mass, and then they tell you that physical exam is notable for like skin dimpling, nipple retraction, leathery, I don't know, like orange peel appearance of the left breast. And then they tell you that she has a long history of depression that has been well controlled with paroxetine. And then they tell you that her mood, her affects, that's all appropriate. And then she tells you that she's not interested in knowing the diagnosis. And then the MBME question is, what is the next best step in the management of this patient? What is the next best step in the management of this patient? So let's say option A says, tell the patient the diagnosis and urge her to consider immediate treatment. So that's option A. And then option B is, respect the patient's wishes and do not tell her the diagnosis. Okay. And then option C is, verbalize to the patient that you think it's best for her to know the diagnosis. And then option D is to call the patient's husband and tell him the diagnosis. And then option E is to ask the patient why she does not want to know the diagnosis, right? So I'll read those again, because this is a classic, you know, tricky ethics question. I love writing questions. It's just, it takes a ridiculous amount of time to write questions. But so again, tell the patient the diagnosis, urge her to consider immediate treatment. Option B, respect the patient's wishes, don't tell her the diagnosis. Option C, verbalize to the patient that you think it's best for her to know the diagnosis. Option D, call the patient's husband, tell him the diagnosis. Option E, ask the patient why she does not want to know the diagnosis, right? So what do you think the best answer here should be? Again, I would really, really hope that you are saying the answer E, okay? This patient likely has like inflammatory breast cancer. So the patient likely has inflammatory breast cancer, right? Now, three of the answers don't make any sense, right? So like option A, where I say, tell the patient the diagnosis. This patient is lucid, she's there, she's not delirious, nothing like that, right? You can't break a patient's autonomy, right? So that's a bogus, you shouldn't choose that. And then option C, right, says, oh, verbalize to the patient that you think it's best for her to know the diagnosis. Can't do that either, right? That's ridiculous. Like, you can't tell the patient that you know what's best for them. No, right? Patients have autonomy. So that's a bogus answer. And then option D, right? Oh, call the patient's husband and tell him the diagnosis. I'm sure there'll be a, you know, very nice attorney that'll be very willing to take your license and take maybe your life savings and whatever you can make for the next couple of years. So don't do that, right? That's breaking HIPAA. That's not smart at all. And then option B actually sounds pretty good, right? Like, you know, respect the patient's wishes, don't tell her the diagnosis, versus option E that says, ask the patient why she does not want to know the diagnosis. Here's the thing. Let me teach you guys a salient rule of ethics questions on MBME exams. The thing is, if you went with option B, you're essentially doing what the patient wants. But here's the thing. I will encourage you on ethics questions. This rule works extremely well. Especially like on the, you know, like the more difficult ethics questions that people are like, man, all these things are all good answers, or like I'm stuck between two. Wherever possible, always try to pick an ethics question answer that encourages more discussion with the patient. It's very important, right? Encourages more discussion with the patient, or at least enables you to obtain more information from the patient, right? You know, just to kind of understand their decision. The thing is, if, for example, you ask the patient, like what I said in option E, like, oh, ask the patient why she doesn't want to know the diagnosis, and the patient is like, you know, firm, competent, and, you know, still refuses to know the diagnosis, then yes, option B will then be appropriate under those circumstances, right? Again, you will very likely see ethics questions on your test. Ethics questions show up a ton on the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. They show up in ridiculous amounts on the Step 3 exam. So those are ethics. You just want to be good at it because it's just one of those things. It will never go away. And even like the medicine residents, the medicine boards, those things have ethics questions for sure. Now, what if you get a question about, like, you know, like a 45-year-old female, she has like a past history of Crohn's, and it's well controlled with like etanercept, right? And then she comes to the ED and she's been complaining of dyspnea. And then she tells you, man, you know, I've not been feeling myself, you know, for the past 12 days, and I've had to skip work because, you know, I'm feeling tired all the time. And then they tell you that her review of systems, you know, is positive for like a non-productive cough. She's had like low-grade fevers. She's had myalgias. And then they tell you that you do a rapid flu screen and it's negative. And then they tell you that, you know, her temperature is 101.4, white count is 14,000. So, I mean, obviously she's febrile. She has a leukocytosis. Her sodium is 131, so she has a mild hyponatremia. And they tell you that her p little AO2, right? So like her arterial oxygen tension is 57, which is obviously very low, right? And then they tell you all of the labs are within normal limits. And then they say a chest x-ray is notable for diffuse ground glass. So let's say they tell you that, oh, on chest x-ray, you see diffuse ground glass interstitial infiltrates. And they tell you she hasn't had any recent sick contacts. And then that you did a PPD screen like 3 years ago and it was negative. And then they say, what is the most likely of, so let's say this is the question, what is the most likely offending organism responsible for this patient's symptoms, right? So what is the most likely offending organism responsible for this patient's symptoms? And let's say they give you option A, and it says like, I don't know, like Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And then option B, let's say it's Pneumocystis jervetzi. And then let's say option C, they tell you it's Legionella pneumophila. And then let's say option D, they tell you that, oh, it's the influenza virus. And then let's say option E, let's pick something generic like strep pneumo. So what do you think the answer here should be? I would really hope that you're telling me that the answer here should be option B, right? This person has a new PCP pneumonia, right? And what are the things that can sort of help you with going with the diagnosis of PCP pneumonia? Well, a few things here actually, right? So if a person has like, you know, like severe hypoxia, I mean, like really look, if you look at the question, the person has like severe hypoxia, right? She has hyponatremia. Believe it or not, your friends at the MBME have started going after this relationship between PCP pneumonia and SIDH. Remember, if you have like any like brain or pulmonary pathology, those things can actually cause SIDH, right? So, and you can see her symptoms have kind of been like subacute, you know, like gone for like the last 12 days. And then they tell you, here's the kicker, right? That she has bilateral interstitial infiltrates on chest x-ray, right? This is all classic for PCP pneumonia, right? And again, some other findings, I guess, that I didn't necessarily mention, but remember that in PCP pneumonia, those people tend to have like very elevated LDH, right? And really the way you make the diagnosis is you can do like an induced sputum sample. You can do like a bronchoalveolar lavage, right? And you will see like organisms that are silver stain positive. If you see that, you know that you're dealing with a PCP pneumonia. And you may say, Divine, but this woman doesn't have HIV, nothing. Why does she have PCP pneumonia? Well, think about it, right? She's on a etanercept. Etanercept is a TNF inhibitor, right? So she's immunosuppressed, right? Remember, in general, before you start a patient on a TNF inhibitor, you do actually need to screen them for TB. It's very important to know. And then you also have to screen them for Hep B. Because Hep B and TB, remember your Bs, Hep B, TB, those can be reactivated when a person starts on a TNF inhibitor, right? And then some other, I guess, high-yield things, right? I guess since we're talking about pneumonias, remember Legionella, right? Legionella, I think of it as causing like pneumonia plus. So it's like a person will have like pneumonia, and then they'll have like severe diarrhea, they'll have hyponatremia, they'll have thrombocytopenia, they'll have abdominal pain, they'll have all these like other systemic symptoms. But the thing is, classically, for them to make you think of Legionella, they'll almost always give you something about like exposure to like air conditioning or like a waterfall or like a business conference, right? So the thing is, because I purposely put that hyponatremia in the question to kind of mess with people's heads a little, right? The thing is, if information is not giving you in a, given to you in an MBME question, don't assume it to be there. Everything you need to answer an MBME question is in the question, right? Is in the question, right? So don't try to make assumptions so that, oh, that, like, oh, let me bring in my own piece of information so that you'll fit this answer I'm really considering in my mind. I promise you, you'll fit that answer and you'll pick the wrong one, right? So you gotta be careful, on your exam, right? If your information is not a QSTEM, don't introduce your own information, right? That is one very nice way your friends at the MBME get people to pick the wrong answers. And why is it not strep pneumo? I mean, strep pneumo, right? It'll cause like a lobar consolidation and the patient's symptoms will be more acute, right? You can have, I promise you, you can have strep pneumo pneumonia for 12 days and be like, you know, chilling and like, oh, you know, I feel bad on day 12, let me come to the, no, trust me. If you have strep pneumo, like those people tend to have, like sometimes there's this preceptor I had, he called it a teeth chattering fever, right? Where the person's like, the person just feels like sick as just, can't use certain words, but really, really sick, right? So, so strep pneumo will cause like a lobar consolidation. The patient's symptoms will be more acute, it'll be more severe, right? So it'll be like, oh, like 2 days ago, they were fine, and then they're feeling like crap, right? And then if a person has TB, right, they'll have like significant B symptoms, like they'll have like very high fevers, night sweats, weight loss, hemoptysis. And again, usually TB will show like a cavitary lesion in the upper lobe of the lung, right? They will not generally have interstitial infiltrates if you're thinking about TB. Now, what if you get a question about like a 33-year-old female comes to the hospital, you know, she's been having like a 2-month history of fatigue, and then they tell you that she has lost interest in many things that previously made her happy, and then they tell you, oh, she's gained 10 pounds, but she has had no increase in appetite, and then they tell you that, oh, on physical exam, you notice that her bilateral lower extremities are, you know, moderately swollen, and that she has missed her, like, her last two periods, and then they say that, oh, the rest of her exam is within normal limits, and then they ask, what is the next best step in the management of this patient? So let's say option A is like check serum TSH levels, right? And then let's say option B is to begin an empiric trial of fluoxetine, right? And then let's say option C is like, you know, get a monospot test for infectious mononucleosis. And then let's say option D is to perform like radioactive iodine uptake scanning. So what do you think the best answer here should be? Well, I hope you're saying to check serum TSH, right? I hope you're saying to check serum TSH. I mean, this lady most likely has hypothyroidism, right? Well, to be honest with you, if this were an OB-GYN question, I would very likely go after, I mean, I know it's not an answer choice that I put out there, but actually getting a urine pregnancy test is not a bad idea in this person, because guess what? Gained weight, swelling of the bilateral lower extremities, missed two periods, that could be pregnancy, right? So this is something to keep in mind, but that's not an answer choice here. That's why I'm entertaining hypothyroidism, right? So this woman is likely hypothyroid, right? So you want to go ahead and check TSH. It will obviously be elevated. Remember, the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the U.S. is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? And the thing is, usually on exams, people that have like Hashimoto's, they tend to have like autoimmune crap going on, like vitiligo or like pernicious anemia causing B12 deficiency, stuff like that, right? And remember that, again, so other autoimmune, like if a person has one autoimmune disease, it places them at high risk of having other autoimmune diseases, right? And remember that Hashimoto's, right, is a sort of like antibodies against thyroperoxidase, so anti-TPO or anti-thyroperoxidase antibodies. And then they'll tell you that, oh, if you check out the thyroid gland on histology, you see like a lymphocytic infiltrate. That's all classic for Hashimoto's. And then remember that if a person has Hashimoto's, initially, like early in their course, they can actually be hyperthyroid because that inflammation can release the preformed thyroid hormone, and then they can be hyperthyroid. In fact, some people call that hashitoxicosis, right? So they can have like a thyrotoxic phase initially. And really the way you treat Hashimoto's is, right, you know, you do levothyroxine replacement. Remember, they can actually give you a question about a person. They say that, oh, a person has a long history of Hashimoto's, and then over the last like 2 months, they've had like this rapidly enlarging neck mass, blah, 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 blah. If you see that, think about thyroid lymphoma, right? Think about thyroid lymphoma. And again, if a person has primary hypothyroidism, right, obviously they'll have like elevated TSH, low T3, low T4, right? But if they told you that a person has like low TSH and low T3, T4, right? What are you thinking about? And I would hope you're thinking about secondary hypothyroidism, right? So remember, there are things that can cause secondary hypothyroidism, like craniopharyngioma. So let's say you have something like compressing the pituitary, or person has a Sheehan syndrome, right? Those can all be associated with secondary hypothyroidism. And please, please, please don't forget, right? If a person has craniopharyngioma, your friends at the MBME, they love to ask what's the embryologic origin of a craniopharyngioma. Please think about the derivation from a Rathke's pouch, okay? That's one thing that, believe it or not, still shows up on. You may say, oh, Divine, that's step one crap. I promise you, it's also step two CK and step three crap. So please don't forget, just burn into your brain forever. And then, if a person has hypothyroidism, right? You know, their T4, T3 is low. That will actually cause an increase in TRH, so thyrotropin-releasing hormone. And the thing is, thyrotropin-releasing hormone is also known as a prolactin-releasing factor. So those people can have a secondary hyperprolactinemia, and that can suppress the HPG axis, right? So that's why this woman has missed the last two periods. And then I guess some other high-yield, you know, quick thyroid pathologies, right? So the Quervain's thyroiditis, right? Those people, it's also called subacute thyroiditis. These people have like, they can be hyperthyroid or they can be hypothyroid, okay? But the hallmark feature on MBM exams is they'll have a painful thyroid gland. And then they'll tell you that, oh, this person has like a history of, like a recent history of viral upper respiratory infection, although sometimes they won't give that at all. And remember, if you do a RIU scan, there'll be like decreased or like almost no uptake on a RIU scan. And then there's this thing called a euthyroid 6 syndrome that occasionally pops up on MBM exams. And really, it's like a diagnosis you should consider when you get a question about a person that's like super sick and their TSH and T3, T4 are like marginally low. It will not be like profoundly low. It will be marginally low. And then hyperestrogenism, right? You remember, if a person, you know, has high levels of estrogen from like PCOS, or if a person is taking OCPs, that can actually increase the levels of a thyroid binding globulin, right? And if your thyroid binding globulin increases, that will raise your total T4, but your free T4 will be normal. And remember, free T4 is like the active, like physiologically useful form of that's the one that's, you know, that's physiologically active. Free T4, not the bound T4. And then remember, most thyroid cancers, right, they tend to be hypofunctional, right? And for the most part, if a person has a thyroid cancer, you want to do like an ultrasound with biopsy. So most times, if a person has a thyroid cancer, their TSH may be, you know, elevated because the cancer is hypofunctional. And again, classic presentation of thyroid cancer, they will likely describe a person, you know, that has had like some kind of radiation therapy for some like upper body neoplasm or like leukemia, and then the person presents with a thyroid nodule. Remember, the biggest risk factor for thyroid cancer, right, is prior history of radiation to the head and neck. And don't forget, right, that the most popular kind of thyroid cancer is papillary thyroid cancer. So remember, papillary thyroid cancer is popular, right? So that's a nice way to remember that. And remember, right, it tends to metastasize to lymph nodes. And that's the one that has the sarcoma bodies and the orphan nuclei. So that's high yield to know. Contrast that with follicular lymph thyroid cancer, right? That doesn't spread to lymph nodes, it spreads hematogenously. That's a buzz phrase you really do need to remember for exams. And the medullary thyroid cancer, right? Remember the association of like MEN2A, MEN2B, autosomal dominant inheritance, RET gene mutation. And remember, if a person has a history of MEN2A or MEN2B, they do need a prophylactic thyroidectomy, because it's not really a matter of if they will get medullary thyroid cancer. It's more a matter of when they will get medullary thyroid cancer. Your risk of getting medullary thyroid cancer if you have MEN2A or MEN2B is 100%. Okay, so that is something you absolutely need to keep in mind for purposes of the exam. And remember that the tumor marker, right, for medullary thyroid cancer is calcitonin. So they can give you a question about a person that has a neck mass, and then they show you an EKG or the prolonged QT interval, right? You should be able to link those ideas together, like the prolonged QT interval is from hypocalcemia, which arose because calcitonin, which is the tumor marker for medullary thyroid cancer, calcitones down your blood calcium levels, right? So that's how they can integrate all that mess together. And then please don't forget, right, that medullary thyroid cancer, right, they can say, oh, on histology, what would you expect, right? You want to, you would, obviously, if you do the Congo red staining, you'll see like the apple green are birefringence. So those are all Ohio things you want to keep in mind. So I think this has gone on for actually like exactly 30 minutes. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I will try my best to make a ton of podcasts over the next few days. I just have so much I really want to share, but just timing is just really an issue. So as I do at the end of every podcast, you know, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for most exams that, essentially, if you're listening to this podcast, I probably tutor the exam you're preparing for. So like step one, 2CK, step 2CS, step three. If you're a medicine resident, the in-training exam, the ABIM board exam. If you need tutoring for like the preclinical med school subject, so if you're an M1 or M2 student, if you're a third year med student, your shelf exams, I offer tutoring for those. And then I do like this longitudinal tutoring I've talked about ad nauseum in my last few podcasts, where if you're a first, second, or third year med student, I tutor you for like your shelf exams or your block exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for the USMLE exam you have upcoming. And again, everyone I've done this with, they've actually been extremely, extremely, extremely successful. So if that's something you're interested in, because at the same time as I'm tutoring for your block exams, say for example, your second year med student, as I'm tutoring you for your block exams, I'm also tutoring you for step one at the same time. So you essentially cover those two pieces of knowledge during that time frame. If there's this USMLE booster course that, again, I've offered for a few months, but I was like, let me test it out first before I start mentioning it on the podcast. But basically, it's like 10 hours for step 2CK and step 3, or 20 hours for step 1, where basically, just listen to the podcast where I talk about it. But essentially, it's ideal for people that are in the last week of their prep, or they're in a situation where they feel like they know most of the information pretty well and they want to integrate things together. Very quick course, but we'll review a lot, like a very vast majority of the high yield things from every subject that are tested on the USMLE exam you're taking. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one like advising, or you can say coaching for those. So like personal statements, rec letters, mock interviews, editing applications. And then I guess the last thing, if you have a buddy that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, OChem, Physics, Histology, Biochem, Physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I really cannot wait for the new MBA season to start. I don't know, I just feel like I don't really watch much in the way of TV other than MBA. So, and I guess like gospel, like messages and music. But yeah, I really don't need the MBA to come right back. So I'm really excited. At least next week, preseason starts. So I guess I'll take what I can get. So I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.